Good morning. This is Jane reading for you on a balmy December 9th. We're going to start with an article with a little bit of Christmas cheer. The headline reads, Towanda Event Venue Combines Goat Yoga with Ugly Christmas Sweaters. Tara Davlin Moore, owner of Willow City Farm out of Pleasant Plains, said she's been organizing goat yoga events for the last 10 years. The popular trend involves the introduction of young goats into an information yoga setting to create a more relaxing environment. We saw goat yoga on YouTube, like everybody else did, and thought that we've got goats, so let's throw in some cocktails and see what we can do, Moore said. And so, 10 years later, we're still doing it. Moore's events always have a theme. For yoga events set around the holidays, an ugly Christmas sweater theme is typically upheld. On Sunday, 10 goats adorned with ugly Christmas sweaters Moore has collected for the past decade participated in a goat yoga session at Old Rugged Barn in Towanda. Joe Morrison, owner of Old Rugged Barn, said she moved to her Towanda home in 2010 after 34 years of teaching in Bloomington for some peace and quiet. But after seeing one of her century-old barns without a purpose, she decided to repurpose the building, add an extension in 2013, and gain permitting for special events from the county in 2016. Old Rugged Barn now hosts a variety of events, including weddings, reunions, graduation parties, and proms. We're always trying to grow, Morrison said. On Saturday, the venue will host a holiday market featuring 53 vendors, live music, dog adoption opportunities, crafts, raffles, and more. Haley Leipold of Bloomington said that she had never done yoga when she first heard about the goat yoga event via social media. I'm just here for the goats, said Leipold, who was accompanied by Tony Mangina of Bloomington. To help ease the concerns of first-time participants, Moore said that those who have never been to a real yoga class will also leave the event having never been to a real class. Attendees to the two sessions also had the opportunity to purchase goat milk products from Willow City Farm, including soy wax candles, goat soap, and goat bath bombs. We love working with small businesses. We bring them, and they bring us, something that's kind of why we love it. Although this was her first time at Old Rugged Barn, Moore said she already had another goat yoga event scheduled at the venue in September 2025. Willow City Farm will also bring their goats to a yoga session at Distill Brewery on May 18th. Although 150 tickets are available between three sessions, Moore anticipates that the event will be sold out by February. For more information on upcoming events in the Bloomington Normal area hosted by Willow City Farm, visit willowcityfarm.com. And in some shocking news from Shelby County, concerning the Shelby County Coroner's death. As the shock news of Shelby County Coroner Brad Flegley's death continued to sink in on Sunday, no details have emerged to suggest that what happened to him was anything other than some kind of tragic accident or medical event. A post-mortem examination of the 67-year-old coroner's remains was scheduled to have been carried out on Saturday in Bloomington. Flegley's hunting partner had found his body floating in Lake Mattoon around 2:49 p.m. Friday near a blind and decoys where they were waterfowl hunting. He had been pronounced dead at the scene. Shelby County Board Chairman Tad Mayhall, a Republican of Shelbyville, told the Herald and Review on Sunday that he had not heard any updated news on the cause of death, but he said that he had spoken previously with Shelby County Sheriff Brian McReynolds about the circumstances of what happened. He told me that if there was any change about the circumstances, he would let me and the state's attorney know, he said, and noted there had been no updates. Mayhall said he was grateful to Moultrie County Coroner Lynn Reed for stepping in so quickly to maintain coroner's office services for Shelby County while a replacement for Flegley is sorted out. "It's been a very quick learning experience for me since Friday afternoon," Mayhall said. "Mr. Reed has been very helpful, and even as he said, this is a very uncommon situation to be in, and we will navigate it as best we can." The chairman said he expected to have updated news release ready sometime on Monday on how the coroner's office will cope going forward. He said as things settle down, the county will turn its attention to honoring Flegley's memory and saluting his service. Just reelected in the last election unopposed after a convincing win in the Republican primary in March, Flegley had served as coroner for the last 4 years. A retired state police trooper, he had also served as deputy coroner for 8 years. A keen hunter and outdoors enthusiast, Flegley's Facebook page is filled with pictures of him with specimen fish and animals he caught and hunted over many years. His death comes as the latest in a series of blows to Shelby County, which has been rocked by a recent history of disputes and bitter political fights. Mayall, newly chosen as chairman in the wake of November's election that changed the face of the county board, said the task now was to cope with the coroner's death, honor his memory, and ensure the citizens get the services and government they need. "It's been an arduous, challenging time for sure," he said. "But I think that with the recent swearing-in just this past Monday, and with a new group of board members and a change of leadership, if you can put your ear to the ground and hear what the community is saying, they are asking for less contention and more productivity and for calm. I personally take responsibility that it is my job to make sure that happens. We also want to make sure we are incredibly respectful for the time and service Mr. Flegley has given and acknowledge the emotional toll all this has taken on his family." Here's a cool kind of mystery story out of Chicago for all you book lovers. The headline reads, "Chicago man and his dog find a stash of rare books on the sidewalk. 8 months later, library solves the mystery." On an evening walk in Chicago's North Center neighborhood back in early March, Sparky, Robert Miller's golden brown mutt that weighs 35 pounds and has a hunting dog in his DNA, seemingly caught a scent. "She's a creature of habit," said Miller, a retired 75-year-old who has lived in the neighborhood for about a dozen years. "She likes to stay on one side of the street, and for some reason, she wanted to cross over." A half a block later, the duo stumbled upon a stash of strewn books. "It was about 8 o'clock at night. It was dark. It was winter. And I looked around, and there was not another soul in sight," Miller said. As luck would have it, Miller studied history in college and knew what he was looking at. German books from the Renaissance and early modern period. The oldest, he would later learn, was from 1525. Three were written in Latin, three in German, and one in French. Horrified that the books would get damaged, dirty and damp, lying in such proximity to the city street all night, Miller scooped them up for safekeeping. He couldn't fathom how the delicate vessels of knowledge got stranded on the sidewalk. He wondered whether they had been discarded by thieves who failed to profit off them without provenance, which is ownership history of valuable objects. Perhaps an irritated lover in a moment of passion took a partner's books and chucked them outside after a domestic dispute. 8 months later, a clue dug up by a Newbury Library curator poked fatal holes in both of Miller's hypotheses. Miller had reached out to the library for guidance, and a bit of sleuthing by the curator, Suzanne Carr Schmidt, led to a neighbor of Miller who collects rare books. The neighbor, an octogenarian who hasn't retired, was tidying up some old archival boxes and accidentally took one with the books out to the trash as well, according to Carr Schmidt, who explained the book's mysterious appearance in an article for Newbery Magazine. It seems that the box fell on the ground, spilling its contents, Carschmidt wrote. Before it occurred to him to return to look for it, his relatively close neighbors, Miller and Sparky, had swooped in to protect the books. In the puzzling darkness on an unfamiliar side of the street, Miller stuffed the smaller books in his pockets and hauled the hefty ones away in his arms. At one point, Miller managed to pick up Sparky's poop without dropping the entire bundle. Upon returning home, Miller started sorting through the finding on his dining room table with his wife. He said he knew enough Latin to figure out that one of the books contained arguments against the teachings of Martin Luther, the German priest who helped begin the Protestant Reformation. The next morning, Miller took one of the books to a local police station, which was unable to help Miller locate the book's owner. So Miller contacted the University of Chicago and Newberry Libraries to ask if they were missing the books. They weren't, but they were interested in trying to find out where they came from, Miller said. In photos of the books Miller sent to Carr Schmidt, she saw signs of their 16th century owners, but no recent institutional markings. That told her books likely belonged to an unidentified bookseller or private collector, not another library. After this round of efforts to locate an owner, according to Carr Schmidt, Miller offered to give the books to the Newberry Library. I felt they belonged in some place where they would be appreciated and where they would be cared for properly, Miller said. It is considered unethical for a library to accept books with non-existent provenances, the record of ownership, without making more attempts to identify recent owners. The library did its due diligence. Carr Schmidt learned that two Midwestern collections, each, had one of the books, but never held the complete set. She also circulated details of the find among the international antiquarian bookseller community, but to no avail. The library decided that if someone ever came forward and claimed to be the owner, it would dutifully consider the assertion and give back the books if the proof was deemed convincing. Then, on November 1st, while in the process of editing the magazine article about the books, Carr Schmidt stumbled upon a photo of one of them on the website of Austrian book dealer Antiquariat in Libris. The dealer would inform Carr Schmidt that he sold the books in 2021 and identified to her the Chicagoan who bought it. On November 5th, the owner, who couldn't be reached for comment, stopped by the Newberry Library where he was reunited with his lost books, Carr Schmidt said. He even decided to donate two of them to the library, a text supporting Luther, written in the vernacular German, and one attacking the great reformer in Latin. Carr Schmidt said someone assessing the stores of the Newberry Library, which historically has collected more French and Italian books from before 1800 than German books, may want to view the text for several reasons. They could be interested in the sort of political animosity that's going on between the pair of these. There were a lot of pamphlets written at this time, pro and anti-Luther, Carr Schmidt said. There's also a lot of visual imagery. On the pages of the book written in German, the text is surrounded by ornate woodcut or metal-cut borders, some of which feature Luther's face in a surprised expression. And now for something completely different, the whole controversy on whether or not you should remove your shoes when you enter someone's house. The title of this little op-ed piece is The Great Divide on Socks. We are in the midst of a great controversy in this country, one that is dividing families, friends, and strangers. The fault lines are not divided by gender, race, or age. I was going to include culture as well, but then realized culture, and to some extent individual beliefs, are at the heart of the matter. This controversy has strained friendships and families, each side not fully understanding the other side's position, let alone how they came to this stance. I'm referring to whether a person should remove their shoes upon entering a dwelling. what did you think I was leading to? In parts of the country, this is a low-level but real clash of behaviors and expectations. When going into someone's house, do I need to remove my shoes? Do I have to? And or are they expecting me to? What about how I feel about this? What about my beliefs? There are so many questions. Are there any correct answers? What if I didn't prepare or anticipate this in advance? I'm quite sure that nearly everyone reading today's column has encountered this at least sometime. Let me tell you, it is a combo platter that can include a cultural component, a practical consideration, perhaps a religious factor, and safety issues, both for and against removing one's shoes. No wonder it can be so divisive, as well as a little befuddling. On the practical level, especially if you live in a place of snow, slush, and mud, removing one's damp, wet footwear cuts down on the post-visit cleaning the homeowner must do. There is also a belief that the bottom of shoes are a conglomeration of dirt, animal waste, germs, and or other disgusting things that the homeowner doesn't want in their house. These arguments are the basis for some cultural and religious beliefs that shoes are inherently dirty, and thus the removal of shoes in religious or special places is necessary. This is also, in some parts of the world, why throwing a shoe at someone is one of the gravest insults a person can do. This was illustrated several weeks back when someone threw a shoe at then-President George W. Bush's the younger during a news conference or event of some kind. On the other side of the argument, people may be more inclined to slip and fall just padding around the house in socks, especially with the recent trend of hardwood floors proliferating in different parts of the house. Also, people have special shoes for podiatry reasons that they want to remain private, or that some people with balance issues are more sure-footed in shoes. Then there's the whole preparedness issue. They may not expect to have to remove their shoes and are wearing their Sunday socks, you know, holy, as in holes in the toes or heels. Would a host really want to embarrass an invited guest by making them reveal the less-than-perfect socks, or even occasional person who is sockless in their shoes? To me, bare feet are more unsanitary than anything else. I can see both sides of the issue, but I lean toward keeping my shoes on. Purely personal preference, I know. But as the wife points out, I rarely am without my shoes on my feet any time I am upright, even when I'm at the beach. And here's some news for beer lovers. Pennsylvania-based Yuengling is bringing its beer to Illinois. It took only 195 years, but Pennsylvania-based Yuengling Beer, a regional favorite and the nation's oldest brewery, is finally coming to Illinois. Beginning late next month, beer drinkers can be on the lookout for Yuengling at Illinois bars as the historic family-owned East Coast brewery continued its slow expansion westward into the land of Old Style. Yuengling beers will also make their way onto store shelves in the weeks that follow, ending years of waiting for Illinois fans, some of whom take regular interstate journeys to fill their trunks with cases of the stuff. I think there's definitely pent-up demand in markets that don't have Yuengling, said Wendy Yuengling, a sixth-generation family owner and chief administration officer at the brewery. Founded in 1829 by German immigrant D.G. Yuengling, the brewery was located along a river in the small mining town of Pottsville, where it is still headquartered about 90 miles northwest of Philadelphia. A regional brewery for most of its history, Yuengling began expanding beyond its East Coast base at the dawn of the new millennium, buying a Tampa facility and opening a third plant in Pennsylvania as it built its footprint into 22 states. Yuengling made it to Indiana in 2017. In 2020, it entered into a joint venture with Chicago-based Molson Coors, enabling it to produce its beers at plants in Fort Worth and Milwaukee, and facilitate distribution into new states. Yengling expanded into Texas in 2021 and last year added Kansas, Missouri, and Oklahoma through the joint venture. Next month, Yengling will be available in 27 states when Illinois joins the fold. The Pennsylvania brewer has traveled pretty far, growing into the ninth largest U.S. beer supplier by volume, producing 2.7 million barrels last year, a nearly 16% annual increase, according to Beer Marketers Insights, an industry trade publication. Benji Steinman, president of Beer Marketers Insight, said Yengling is among the last regional brewers left standing in an age of consolidation, giving its craft beer cachet at something closer to a Joe six-pack price. It was a mainstream beer that tasted a little different, and as it expanded, it was embraced. Nationally, Yengling had 1.4% market share last year, despite being in about half the states. Anheuser-Busch led the way at 34.5%, followed by Molson Coors at about 22%, and Constellation at a nearly 15% share, according to Beer Marketers Insights. Constellation Brands Beer Division, based in Chicago, makes and imports Mexican beers such as Corona and Modelo. Steinman and Yengling not only benefited last year from its successful expansion into three states, but also fallout from a Bud Light marketing debacle, which slashed sales of the best-selling beer in the U.S. by 27%. The April 2023 Bud Light social media campaign with a transgender influencer prompted a national boycott and sales decline, which has continued into this year, Steinman said, creating the opportunity for competitive brands to gain share. Miller Lite and Coors Light were the big beneficiaries, Steinman said, but Yengling and Pabst also got big benefits. Beer sales volume is down 6.7% nationally over the past decade, but Yengling has been roughly flat, due in large part to the westward expansion. How the Pennsylvania brewery fares in Illinois, a 7.4 million barrel market last year, remains to be seen, Steinman said. But if it captures 3% of the market, that could substantially boost its national standing. Colin Callahan, the brewery's general manager, said Yengling is not focused on a specific Illinois market share target, but hopes to make a splash in 2025. We expect to be competitive in Illinois, Callahan said. Yengling will launch with five brands in Illinois, its flagship traditional lager, light lager, black and tan, golden pilsner, and Flight, a new upscale light beer. The company plans to use a variety of media as well as in-store and in-restaurant sampling to get consumers to try the brands. The messaging will be simple, according to Wendy Yengling, focusing on the company and the quality of its beers. In terms of marketing, when we launch, we're really just telling the story of who we are, Yengling said. We're America's oldest brewery. We're still family-owned and operated. One hurdle may be teaching Illinoisans how to pronounce the name. In Pennsylvania, Republican state candidate David McCormick took some heat during the campaign when he mangled a reference to the home brew, calling it Yengling, but he still managed to defeat incumbent Bob Casey in November. The correct pronunciation is Yengling. Building market share may start members of a Facebook group, Bring Yengling Beer to Illinois, which has 1,300 followers who have been posting for years about crossing into Indiana for beer runs and ruminating on their favorite brew when it would be available in their home state. I'll believe it when I see it, was a common refrain among members when rumors of its imminent arrival were posted on Facebook group page in July. If all goes well, they'll begin to see Yengling for sale in their areas by late January, providing what the company hopes will be an early sales catalyst for the new beer in town. We've seen that in other markets where we've launched, and that's helped seed some excitement early on because you've got that group of consumers that are waiting for the brand, said Yengling.
And here's a piece for you dog lovers.
headlined Dogs with Epilepsy. This is written by Sharon Albright of the American Kennel Club. Just like people, dogs can suffer from epilepsy. This seizure disorder is characterized by uncontrolled electrical activity in the brain resulting in abnormal movements, altered behavior, and/or loss of consciousness. Seizures can have many causes, such as trauma, infection, metabolic disturbances, brain tumors, and more. When no specific cause can be pinpointed, it's known as idiopathic epilepsy. Idiopathic epilepsy is the most common medical neurologic disorder of dogs and is reported to affect one in every 100 dogs. Diagnosis, often made in young to middle-aged dogs, involves a full medical workup to rule out underlying causes and treat any concurrent diseases. This may include blood work, imaging such as MRI or CT scans, a cerebrospinal fluid analysis, etc. The condition requires lifelong management, creating a significant financial and emotional burden for affected dogs and their families. Treatment for idiopathic epilepsy involves avoiding or managing seizure triggers such as anxiety, stress, or certain foods. If seizures are severe or occur frequently enough, anti-seizure medications are prescribed. There are numerous anti-seizure drugs approved for use in dogs. They must be taken as prescribed and should not be stopped without consulting a veterinarian, as doing so may trigger more seizure activity. Multiple medications may be needed to adequately control a dog's seizures, and a good relationship with a veterinary team is critical for successful outcomes. Additional treatment options include nutritional supplements, dietary therapy, and even traditional Chinese veterinary medicine. All treatments should be given under the guidance of a licensed professional to avoid dangerous side effects and medication interactions. Despite appropriate anti-epileptic therapy, about one-third of dogs with idiopathic epilepsy will continue to have seizures. If we better understand exactly what, where, and how the brain malfunctions in epileptic dogs, we might be able to discern different types of epilepsy, create a more accurate diagnostic test, and develop more effective treatments for this challenging disease. Thanks to funding from AKC Canine Health Foundation, a nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing the health of all dogs through scientific research, veterinary scientists are actively searching for these answers. Since its founding in 1995, the Canine Health Foundation and its donors have invested more than $3 million to study canine epilepsy, resulting in significant progress. As far as dietary supplements go, studies show that supplementation with medium-chain triglyceride oil decreases seizure frequency and improves the behavioral changes that commonly occur with epilepsy. Genetic research has shown specific genetic mutations linked to an increased risk of epilepsy in dog breeds like the Belgian Tervuren and Belgian Sheepdog allow breeders and veterinarians to conduct preventive screenings and manage idiopathic epilepsy in these breeds. CBD oil efficacy. Additional research has demonstrated CBD oil is an effective treatment for canine epilepsy, providing critical scientific evidence for the use of this popular remedy. Ongoing Canine Health Foundation-funded studies are building on these findings to provide new diagnostic and treatment options for epileptic dogs. Anyone interested in learning about these opportunities and supporting this critical canine health research can visit www.akcchf.org/epilepsy for more information.